Anyways, oh my gosh, we are in the middle of the 12 steps, going through the 12 steps, and we're up to step 10. And I was thinking about how this step really interfaces with our lives on a deep level. And I want to see if I can express something to you, and I'm not sure I can quite get it across, but I'm going to try. So if it's one of those things where you just kind of look at me like, okay, what's he talking about, Dave? Just bear with me for a minute, and let's see if it's the good news is, if it doesn't come across, it's not totally essential to the point, but it'll help illustrate it. How about that? Right now, everybody just raise your right hand like you're going to take an oath. Thank you, buddy. Appreciate it. Okay. Got your hand up. Now you can put it back down again. Put it back up again. Think about it. What just happened there? Okay, you can put him back down again. Well, what just happened there? You know, sometimes the simplest things in life are not only the most mysterious, but the most miraculous. I mean, think about what just happened there. I had a thought in my head. I had an intent. And somehow that just dropped down onto my tongue and right out into this microphone. And I said, raise your right hand. And all your hands went up. How did your hands go up? What did you actually do? The words probably didn't form in your mind, oh, I got to raise my hand now. You just had the intent, and there was your hand in the air. How did that happen? How did those thoughts, those intents, go through your body into your hand and raise your hand, and then you put it back down again? How does that work? Can you explain that to me? How does a mind work? How do we think these thoughts that we think all day long? How do we store memories? How do we bring them back up again? More importantly, I want to know what happens when you forget. You know, when you got that word or that name that it's right on the tip of your tongue and you can't quite get it, and okay, it looks like this, it sounds like this, it starts with a C, where did it go? And how is it that you're calling it back? And how do you call it back? You know, these things to me are absolutely amazing. Marion and I went and saw a movie last week. It was a horrible movie. One of the worst that I've ever seen. I mean, it was top to bottom bad. You know, bad score, bad script, bad acting, bad production values. Just terrible. Now, until you see a really bad movie like that, you don't really think about all the good movies because, you know, pretty much production values are pretty high in the movies that actually make it to market. And then you see one like that and you go, wow, I really appreciate the good movies now. You know, we take things for granted because they're commonplace, because they're everyday occurrences. I sometimes marvel at just at listening to conversations. How is it that we carry on a conversation? The words that come out, we react to the other words. Emotions get involved. I was driving across Ortega overpass right here. You know how it's a parking lot right now? So I'm stuck right there. Everything is jammed in both directions. So I'm sitting there waiting for something to move, and I look on the car coming toward me. There's two women sitting in the driver and passenger seat, and the driver is speaking to the other woman. And I don't think I've ever seen anyone use her hands so much in her speech. It looked like she was conducting an orchestra. And she was just animated and going all over the place, and the other woman was just sitting completely still. And I'm just smiling, watching this, all this stuff going on. Sometimes I just sit in gatherings off to the side a little bit and just watch all the knots of conversations and all the things that are going on and all the people and the interactions. Sometimes I'm working up in the loft where my office is at home and I hear Brennan and Marion talking, and I sometimes can't make out the words, but I can just hear the lilt and the contour of the voices and sometimes the laughter. These things that are everyday, we take for granted until the moment that we can't do them anymore. And then suddenly they become very precious to us. Do you know what the dictionary definition of a miracle is? It's an event that's inexplicable by natural or physical laws. Well, can you explain to me what you did when you popped your hand up? I can't. To me, that's a miracle. Oh, yeah, I know some scientists could explain it and tell you what's going on and all this sort of thing, but I can't. To me, it's a miracle. And not only that, what I find is that scientists are really good at explaining and expressing processes that are all in motion, but when it comes to inception, not so much. How did all this start? Where did it begin? That's a miracle. We relegate miracles to these spectacular things. You know, we look for them. We try to see how they're going to impact our lives, and we pray for them. But every day, we're missing all of these things. Because something is commonplace doesn't mean it's any less a miracle under these definitions. And I think there's really a better definition of a miracle. And that it's a gift that we cannot give ourselves. To me, that's a miracle. There are things that we need every day. We are so dependent, it's ridiculous. How do we take the next breath? Where does that come from? And how do we give that soul to ourselves? How were we born in the first place? You know, maybe somehow we asked for it in another life. I don't know, but I don't know how it works now. But here I am. How did I grow? You know, how did our children come into being? All of these things that we so take for granted because they happen so much every single day. If you stop and think about them, they're absolutely miraculous. A couple of weeks ago, I quoted Abraham Heschel, you know, a prominent Jewish rabbi. And he wrote that his greatest talent was the ability to be surprised. Think about that. His greatest talent is the ability to be surprised. Are you surprisable? Are you amazable? See, when we start to define all these little things as gifts that we can't give ourselves, then we're grateful. If you get a gift that you could never give yourself, what other attitude is there but gratitude? And as soon as you're grateful, it puts you into a completely different place. And that place is what Jesus calls kingdom. It's the right here and right now awareness of the presence of God and his gifts and his provision and everything that he has for us. And if you can see that gift as what it is, a miracle, then you're amazed. To go through life grateful and amazed, now we're talking. This is what Jesus intended. This is what the Father intended. This is what the Spirit helps us, if we're willing, to move into. To live in a state where we're grateful and amazed is absolutely amazing. And how often do we do it? When do we do it? How do we do it? How can we get into this process or get into this state of being grateful and amazed? I told the story of, I told it years ago, and I think I told it not too long ago. So if you heard it, bear with me for a second. Marion and I were married only 4 months at this moment, this time I want to tell you about, although we had been going together exclusively for 3 years, so we knew each other pretty well, but only 4 months married. And she was at work, and I was at work, and I needed to get a filing cabinet, I think, or something for her. So I decided midday to go to Target. And I went to Target, and I'm walking up and down the aisles looking for the home office section. And I look down one aisle, and I see this woman coming toward me pushing a cart. And she just struck me because she was beautiful. And the way she carried herself and the way she was walking, and she kind of turned my head, and I looked. And it was a full, I think, 3 seconds before I realized it was Marion. Can you get in trouble for checking out your own wife? I don't think so. You know, it was a couple of days later that I realized what a gift I had been given. At that point in our lives together, I got a moment to see her as I saw her for the first time, completely unfiltered, just as she was, not colored by anything I knew of her or anything that we'd gone through. To see her again for the first time was a great gift. Can we cultivate that gift for ourselves? See, what is the 10th step really about? Let's read it. It's right there in your bulletins if you want to take a look. Continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Okay, now that just sounds really cut and dried, right? It just sounds like we're just going to keep dredging up our character defects. We're going to keep making a list of all the things that we do wrong. But if you really think about what the 10th step is, it's the practice of seeing things as if for the first time. It's constantly taking this experience of our day in the moments themselves and then at the end of the day and kind of bringing ourselves back to awareness. Not just recounting deficits and defects, but seeing ourselves, seeing our lives again, anew, as if for the first time. Have you heard the expression, familiarity breeds contempt? Take a look at this wonderful little quote from G.K. Chesterton. How many of you have heard of G.K. Chesterton? There you go. See, your hands went up again. How'd you do that? All right, I just don't know. He writes, "We see things fairly when we see them first. We must try to recover the candor and wonder of the child, the unspoiled realism and objectivity of innocence. Or if we cannot do that, we must try at least to shake off the cloud of mere custom and see the thing as new, if only by seeing it as unnatural. Things that may well be familiar, so long as familiarity breeds affection, had much better become unfamiliar, when unfamiliarity breeds contempt." I read that all wrong. Let me try that last sentence again. "Things may well be familiar, so long as familiarity breeds affection." I blew it again, didn't I? Did I say that right? How come it's not making sense to me? I put this in the bulletin, for crying out loud. "Things that may well be familiar, so long as familiarity breeds affection, had much better become unfamiliar when familiarity breeds contempt." Okay, did that make sense to you? Thank you. Okay, the brain not working. What happened there? I don't know. See, here's the thing. It may not actually be contempt that the familiarity breeds, but it does breed apathy. It does breed complacency. It does allow us to take things for granted that should not be taken for granted, because they're absolutely amazing. We got to find a way to cut through the familiar. We got to start being able to see ourselves with new insight, with a clarity, with an objectivity, so that we can choose differently in our moments. That's the key. We want to choose differently in our moments, because the way that we have chosen before, when we're not aware, when we're not thinking about these things, when everything seems so familiar, is taking us on these paths, these cycles of dysfunction that break up our relationships, that foster and fuel our addictions and our compulsions. So this is what we're trying to do. And this is what the 10th step is, if you really think about it. I like to think of the 10th step sort of as the fulcrum. You know what a fulcrum is? You know that little thing you balance a board on, and it balances this way on a barrel or on some. That's the fulcrum. The 10th step is kind of the fulcrum, because the first 9 steps lead up to it and the last 2 steps lead away from it. It's right here in the middle. The 12 and 12 talks about it as the acid test. Talks about it as a way of living day by day in fair weather and in foul. Sometimes you hear it described as a maintenance step. I hate that, because maintenance to me is a 4-letter word. I don't like maintenance. How about a becoming step? Is that better? I think it's better for me. It's this way of living life day to day, fair weather or foul. How do we do that? The 10th step really then is simply living life, but with purpose. Living life as if it had meaning, because it actually does. Really seeing life, seeing our relationships. So how does that work? How do we do that? This metaphor has been with me for about, 25 years. Before I reignited my Christian walk, I was looking in all different directions for something that made any kind of sense. And one of the things I worked on was called lucid dreaming. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with lucid dreaming. Okay, another hand there. Lucid dreaming is a dream in which you wake up in the dream enough to know that you're dreaming, but not enough to wake up completely and exit the dream. Something happens when you realize you're dreaming and you wake up inside that dream. Now you can control the dream. You can make choices within the dream, because your brain doesn't know the difference between the waking life and the dream state. It just assumes everything is real, right? And so you just follow that dream as if you're pre-programmed to follow it, unless you wake up and realize it's a dream. And then you can do all sorts of things. You know, you can choose to jump like Michael Jordan. You can fly. You can do all sorts. You can change characters, change scenes. It's almost like a vacation inside your head, which is exactly what I was going for at the time, because my life was so miserable. I was looking for ways to find vacations inside my head. You know, pretty pathetic, but there it is. I'm sorry. Now, how do you get to the point where you can actually have a lucid dream? Well, you got to practice. How do you practice? In your waking state, you're constantly questioning your state of consciousness. So I'd be sitting here right now with you, and I'd be saying, okay, am I awake or am I dreaming? And I'd be looking for cues and clues to see. Like, we're all sitting here, but we're in the front room of the house I grew up in. You know how dreams do that? Juxtapose things? You know, that would be my first clue. Something's wrong here. You know? All right. Maybe the color is off. Maybe the perspective is off. Something is off. And as I start to gather those clues, and I suspect I might be dreaming, then there are things that I can do. And there are little techniques. You look at your hands. You try to read something. You know you can't read anything in a dream? Have you ever tried? The words just move and morph and jumble around. You can't do it. So you try that, and now you're pretty sure you're dreaming, so try to do something impossible. Try to take that jump like Michael Jordan. Best lucid dream I had, I was sitting in a balcony, some high-up penthouse balcony with a friend of mine, and looking out over this bay, and I thought it was San Diego. But as I was looking, it didn't quite look right, and I was seeing detail at the far side of the bay that was way too clear. So I started to suspect, I'm dreaming. I'm sure I'm dreaming. So my choice was to get up and jump over the balcony. Now, I don't recommend that, but it worked this time, and I'm falling. I get a couple of feet from the ground, and I just stop, and I'm hovering there. And then I chose to fly out over the water and look at every, you know, look at the buildings and look at people through the windows and just see their lives going by. And it was amazing. But you cannot do that unless you've practiced in the waking state to consciously question your consciousness. If you haven't practiced it then when you move into the dream state, you won't do it there either. And so it's a constant questioning. It's a constant awareness of where you are and what state you're in. This is a perfect metaphor for life. Because most of us are sleepwalking through our lives. We sleepwalk through our moments. We're not really there. Do you have whole sections of your life where you really don't have any clear memories? My whole 20s are like that. I can tell you what I did. I can recount it. But the memories are not clear. They're not vivid because I wasn't present. I wasn't really there. I sleepwalked through the whole thing. And as you sleepwalk through your moments, when you're triggered, it's just stimulus response with no thought in between. To wake up inside your moments, to realize that you actually have a choice, is just like waking up inside your dream and realizing the same thing. And so here is this practice. Here is this thing that we need to do day in and day out. To practice presence. To practice questioning where we are and what we're doing and how we are interacting with the people around us and the circumstances around us. And so the 10th step is doing that for us, not just at the end of the day or at certain times, but moment by moment, reevaluating, recentering, re-relationshipping, if you will, remaking, recreating, reamending, doing everything that we need to do to bring ourselves back into balance, to make sure that we are continuing to live aware of the things that are going around us and aware of these commonplace miracles that are taking place every single day. The effect that we're having on others because of our choices. To take us into this place of awareness that allows us to be grateful and amazed. To move back into what Jesus calls kingdom. So, take a moment here though. If we're going to be working this hard on this, hard to remain surprised, amazable, and all these things, then how is this really a gift that we can't give ourselves? Aren't we really working for it? Haven't we earned it? How can we be grateful if we earn this thing because we work so hard? How does that work? And I want to broaden the scope here a little bit because there's many of you here who aren't in recovery per se, and you might be thinking, well, does this really apply to me? Absolutely it applies. It applies to every single one of us. Not just because every one of us is recovering from something, but this idea of recovery as we're talking about it, true transformation, a complete inside-out overhaul, is completely analogous to the biblical idea of salvation. To the Jews that Jesus taught, salvation was spiritual liberation right here and right now. Now we've broadened that to include what happens in the next life. But the idea was, just like kingdom, salvation begins here. Salvation begins now. And it extends into the next life. But we all know salvation is supposed to be a free gift, right? Let's read Ephesians 2, verse 8 and 9, right there. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and not of yourselves. It is the gift of God, not as a result of works, so that no one may boast. So here's this classic conundrum about salvation. Is it by faith or is it by works? And it seems like we're schizophrenic as Christians, going back and forth. You know, salvation, yes, it's a free gift. We can't earn it. At the same time, yeah, but you better do this or this or this. You're still going to hell. So which is it? And how do we understand what salvation really is? And to make things more confusing, if you read Philippians 2, at verse 12, Paul is writing again. So then, my beloved, just as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. So we're talking about salvation in the context of recovery and in the context of transformation. And now it seems like we've got two very contrary things going on here, and it gets confusing. Is it a gift that we can't give ourselves, or is it something we work at? And the beautiful thing is the answer is in the very next verse. This is something that Pat's been pointing out to me. And he's absolutely right. Look at verse 13. For it is God who is at work in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. So the idea is that salvation is God's work in us. The recovery is God's work in us. Transformation is God's work in us. But we're not just a potted plant here either. You know, we are in partnership with God to allow his work in us to continue. Look at the words used here. Work out your salvation. Work out. That word there, either in the Greek or the Aramaic, means to pursue continuously, to pursue consistently a completed work. You've got to go after it. There's something that we do. All right? And this idea of fear and trembling, that messes us up so much in our vernacular here. Sounds like we're supposed to be afraid and scared of this whole thing, which means that we're afraid of our punishment if we don't do this right, right? Yeah, I'm not going to work it out, so I'm going to hell, so I'm all afraid and trembling about this. No, fear and trembling is another idiomatic phrase. You know what an idiom is? It's a phrase, it's a saying that you cannot get the meaning out of just by summing up the definitions of the words that were used. In other words, people agreed what it meant. You know that in 1 Corinthians, Paul talks about himself going to Corinth and feeling about his responsibility to the church at Corinth as arriving with fear and trembling. In 2 Corinthians 7, he talks about Titus being received by the Corinthians with fear and trembling. It really just means respect and humility. That's really what's going on here. Reverence and respect and humility. It means that you really see the relationship here between you and God, or you and the people that you're serving, or the people who are serving you. You respect that. You got reverence for it. And the humility part is the part that you're realizing, I'm getting a gift I could not give myself. Even as I work to make myself available to that gift. Because if I'm not present to it, if I'm not aware that it exists, how in the world is it going to be effective in my life? That's the partnership part. That's how we work together. The 12 and 12 is interesting in the way that it puts it. Same idea here. And it's talking about people in recovery who have made it a certain way, right? They have got some sobriety under their belt. They've gotten a certain way, and they're starting to feel pretty good about themselves, right? When temporary good fortune came our way, we indulged ourselves in fantasies of still greater victories over people and circumstances. Thus, blinded by prideful self-confidence, we are apt to play the big shot. Of course, people turned away from us, bored or hurt. Now that we're in AA and sober and winning back the esteem of our friends and business associates, we find that we still need to exercise special vigilance. As an insurance against big shotism, we can often check ourselves by remembering that we are today sober only by the grace of God, and that any success we may be having is far more His success than ours. We're still powerless. You get that? How powerless we really are? Jesus said you can't turn one hair white or black. You can't add an inch to your stature, an hour to your life. If you can't change these most basic things of life, how is it that you think you have any control? We literally live lives like 2-year-olds, you know, running around the house thinking we got some control. I can say no to mom now. I've got control. And mom just smiles sweetly and changes your diapers, you know. It's so funny. Then we open up to the real world around us and we think, oh, we've got this, you know, world domination. Yeah, you're standing on a mud ball in space, spinning through an inconsequential solar system at the back of some inconsequential galaxy among billions of other galaxies. What power do we really have? The fear and trembling that Paul is talking about, the reverence and humility, is right-sizing our relationship. It's acknowledging where we really stand. And to understand that that pure dependence, that utter dependence, puts us into this beautiful place of being able to receive gifts that we can't give ourselves, that make us grateful and amazed. How do we stay in that place? By constantly rehearsing, practicing, working through this, becoming and staying aware of where we are and who we're with. Why do you think this is important? Why is it important to make these kinds of distinctions? There is one of my favorite stories in the Gospel of Luke. And Jesus is passing through town. This is toward, as he's starting to hit his stride, and he's getting known throughout the countryside, and large crowds are starting to follow him. And the Pharisees are trying to figure out what to make of him. They really don't know. You know, many scholars believe that Jesus was a Pharisee. It explains a lot of things. How does a poor kid from Nazareth get the training that Jesus had? How was he able to read and write Hebrew and do the things that he was able to do? How did he know the law so well? How did all of this work out? Well, the Pharisees went around and looked for promising boys in the various communities, and then they brought them into their habarot, their communities, and basically sponsored them. It's one way that Jesus could have got the education that he had, because he was a promising young man in Nazareth. And so he was raised possibly as a Pharisee. At any rate, he followed the law to the letter, and the Pharisees knew that, or they never would have had anything to do with him. So he was close enough to them and their understanding of the law that they would seek him out. And in this case, a Pharisee named Simon, a very influential Pharisee, invites him over to his home for a meal so that he can test him, so that he can talk to him, so he can find out what this guy's all about. Been hearing about him, need to know. And so Jesus accepts, and he goes to the house, and all the crowd comes with him, and so they're jamming the outer courtyard and spilling out into the street, and Jesus is in the dining room. And you have to remember, their dining rooms don't look like our dining rooms. Take Da Vinci's Last Supper and toss it, because nobody's sitting upright at tables. What they would have had is a big room with a U-shaped table, kind of a horseshoe, with couches radiating out the outside edge. And people would lie on their left side on these couches, reclining. And all food was finger food, so they only used their right hand, and they would pick things up and dip and eat, and their left hand stayed tucked underneath them. It seems like an inefficient way for us to do it, but think about in the early days of nomadic life. You're living in a tent. You don't have any furniture. What's the best way to eat your food if you got to sit on the floor? To lie on the floor. And so their culture brought that forward. People would serve from the inside and people would eat. And so you have, if you looked at the outside of the table, what you got are all these feet, a ring of feet sticking out at the back. And of course they would take their sandals off when they hit the door, and they were supposed to have their feet washed by the servants because it was dusty out there. There was a woman who was known as probably the greatest sinner in the whole village, in the whole town. And when she heard that Jesus was going to be at Simon's house, she gathered up every ounce of courage she had. We don't know what her sin was, but we know that she was reviled by the community. And she went out during the day, wrapped her veil around her, and went to Simon's house, and pushed through the crowd in the street, and through the crowd in the courtyard, and gets to the dining room. Somehow no one stops her, and she finds Yeshua. And she goes and kneels in front of his feet, and she is sobbing, and the tears are falling on his feet, and she's wiping them, drying them with her hair. And as the guests are observing this, and Jesus doesn't move a muscle, he just calmly keeps on eating. And they start muttering to themselves, and Simon to himself says, if this man really were a prophet, he would know who's touching him. To be touched by someone who was unclean was to become unclean yourself. And then you had to go through the ritual purification and be declared clean by the temple priest before you could re-enter into society and buy and sell and take food from another's hand. And in their eyes, Jesus was made unclean by this, and he would have known and he would have shrunk away and not let her touch him. Jesus just keeps calmly eating. And then he says, and we can follow along here if you wish. Luke 7, verse 40. And Jesus answers Simon, who is saying these things under his breath or to himself. Simon, I have something to say to you. And Simon replied, say it, teacher. A moneylender had two debtors. One owed 500 denarii and the other 50. When they were unable to repay, he graciously forgave them both. So which of them will love him more? And Simon answered and said, I suppose the one whom he forgave more. And Jesus said to him, you have judged correctly. Turning toward the woman, he said to Simon, do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but she, since the time I came in, has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she anointed my feet with perfume. For this reason, I say to you, her sins, which are many, have been forgiven, for she loved much. But he who is forgiven little, loves little. What is the lesson that Jesus is trying to get across to Simon? If you think you earned it, you're not grateful for it. You're entitled to it. Do you see? This woman knew she did not deserve forgiveness. This woman knew that she deserved to be thrown out of that house. And yet she showed up believing on the chance that Jesus was exactly who everyone said he was. And he was. And she is so grateful to be given a gift that she could not give herself, that she did not deserve. While Simon and the rest of the Pharisees are sitting there thinking, I have spent my entire life dedicated to the law. I have spent my entire life in learning of things of the Lord. I'm entitled to this position at my table. I'm entitled to everything I have. And she is not. There is no gratitude there. There is no ability to be amazed there because everything is earned. Everything is under the yoke of the law. Jesus is trying to get them to understand, and by extension to get us to understand. We don't earn anything. We simply accept the gift that is freely given when we do the work of becoming aware enough and present enough to see it all around us in these everyday miracles that never cease to exist and will never cease to amaze us if we can get excited about just raising our right hand, if we can get excited about the next conversation that we have, exactly as a child would. You see, you can only live in kingdom if you're grateful and amazed. And you can only be grateful and amazed if you're aware and awake in your moments. And you can only be aware and awake in your moments if you practice awareness and presence and awakeness every day. That's what the 10th step is about. It's practicing awareness. It's becoming alive in our moments, in our conversations, in our situations, and see how we're interacting, and course correcting whenever we need to, and repairing bridges whenever we need to, and going through our relationships as if they're the most precious things in our lives, because they are. And they will be to us when we do treat them that way. And the last thing is that we never outgrow the 10th step. No matter how evolved we become, no matter how far we go, you never outgrow the need for this kind of introspection, this kind of practice. I like to say, you know, this lamp over here, how long does it stay lit when you unplug it from the wall? How long do you stay lit as soon as you're unplugged from your source? The 10th step is the means by which we stay plugged in to our source. This source, right here, right now. If we can do this, if we can refine this gratitude, to be grateful and amazed will be just like a child riding dad's shoulders. And you know what that looks like on the child's face? Imagine it on yours. Let's pray. Father, you are so good. You are so generous. You are so forthcoming. You shower us with everything every moment. It's just too good to be true sometimes. Our minds can't wrap around it. Help us to open up. Help us to see just how good you are. How these miracles are occurring every single day in the tiniest of places, in the most familiar of places. Help us to uncover them again. Help us to see them for what they really are. Amazing, astounding things that we can do in you and through you. Thank you for being a God of miracles. Thank you for loving us the way that you do. Continue to pull us, draw us, and guide us into deeper relationship with you and everyone we encounter. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.